This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, June 24th, 2016.
We are absolutely clear now that there is no way that the Remain side can win. It looks as though the gap's going to be something like 52 to 48, so a four-point lead for leaving the EU.
I will do everything I can as Prime Minister to steady the ship, but I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain.
We now expect the United Kingdom government to give effect to this decision.
Absolutely wonderful. The best news ever.
I thought it was extremely sad and disappointing this morning.
Not too happy. We should have stayed in.
Got to get out, you know what I mean? That's what we had to do.
Suddenly we saw a very sharp decline in the value of the pound.
At around 2 o'clock in the morning, UK time, effectively fall off a cliff.
I would reassure those markets and investors that Britain's economy is fundamentally strong.
People want to take their country back.
It was a noble idea for its time. It is no longer right for this country.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Get out your maps, folks. The English Channel is wider today, and those white cliffs of Dover, oh, jump off that cliff. That water's cold. The UK voted to leave the European Union in a surprise outcome for the British political establishment that has tossed the entire British political system into disarray today. Rejoicing right-wing parties from London to Berlin, with markets around the world down 6, 7, and 8%. Gold up 4 and 5%. What happens now, besides the resignation of British Prime Minister David Cameron, who called for this referendum as a kind of insurance policy that blew up like a worthless credit default swap for 8 years ago, what happens now? We don't know. The question is, does this vote lead the world into an economic downturn or just a period of frustrating but not disastrous uncertainty? Joining me now from London is a very grim-sounding broadcaster and historian, Simon Sharma. Sharma has long opposed a British exit or Brexit from the EU.
What we saw last night and what we're seeing all over Europe, and actually I think where you and I live in the United States, is the long result of the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. The net result of that has been grievance. A kind of grievance about inequality, particularly inequality of income. When you have that, it can go two ways. Traditionally, you went for socialism, and the Bernie Sanders phenomenon is an example of the appeal of that. But the other way, of course, is a kind of populist, nationalist tribalism, which has very strong working-class and lower-class blue-collar appeal. We're seeing that as the heartland of Trump's appeal, aren't we? And that's what's happened, really. Socialism has proved not really to be a viable option in Europe at the moment, or it hasn't wanted to fight for itself. But populist tribal nationalism, with all of its visceral emotional force, is absolutely rampant right now.
Well, let's talk for a moment, because I think it's really interesting your link to the 2008 financial crisis, in that we'll not talk about tribalism for just a moment, because this is possibly the first moment, the first window that the disaffected from that recession have had a chance to clearly express their views. There have been a lot of other elections, but this is the one where that group that you're talking about, that hasn't benefited over these last 8 years, that still feels the pain, is able to stand up and say, you know what, we're sticking it to you.
Yes, that's exactly right. You want to really be extremely angry and thrash out at somebody. You need a convenient, I won't say scapegoat, but you need a convenient villain, really. And if a politician, you know, pretends to deliver it to you and call it immigrants, you know, and those were the first words out of the campaign of Donald Trump's mouth, weren't they? Well, they're identical to the words out of the mouth of all those in Europe, other than Britain, who are celebrating this morning, Marine Le Pen and Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. And it was a standard kind of high school thing, the kind of hyperinflation and the depression in the 1920s created fascism, and that's not necessarily wrong. So I don't think history ever repeats itself in a simple-minded, mechanical way. But there is undoubtedly a link, you put it very well, between a sense of aggrieved incomprehension, alienation from the powers that be, and a sense that some people have been able to recover just fine with their bank accounts, but not the working stiff. And that's really behind the rage here. And the scapegoat of convenience are immigrants.
Looking at the tribal piece, because you are such a student of history, particularly British history and European for that matter, but, you know, I described this earlier as a throwback to, you know, if not Victorianism, then, you know, almost, you know, Stonehenge and the Druids. I mean, this is really a deep, deep feeling to be separated from Europe. And it was misread by everyone in the British establishment. Can you describe a little bit what's going on here in this pot that was stirred?
To all intents and purposes, the kind of mythology of a separate, of British exceptionalism, if you like, of going a separate way has remained very strong. But when there is this sort of extraordinary, I mean, Dunkirk and Churchill's been mentioned over and over again, when you're in a state of confusion and dismay and you flock to the slogan, take our country back, you are thinking of the John of Gaunt speech in Shakespeare's Richard II of the Sceptred Isle, of your separateness. And separateness, you know, I said in a piece I wrote in the Financial Times that another word for declaring independence or separation is solitariness, is just being alone. So we will not recover our sovereignty. And we discovered very quickly from the collapse of the pound that this is a very partial sovereignty. We'll just be alone. It's an extremely alluring myth. And this sort of sense that we have a profound homeland somewhere in our imagination is very, very deep, and it's extremely seductive in when you feel aggrieved and unequal and alienated, and that's what you cleave to. And, you know, there's nothing to distinguish that appeal from, you know, make America great again. I mean, it's exactly the same thing.
Assuming that there isn't another world war and... You know, I don't...
No, there won't be.
You were right.
No, you were very, as usual, incredibly astute. Going back to the 19th century, we always forget how ugly resurgent nationalism was in the 1800s. And that's when the sense in which you own your national memory, your music, your food, and you just don't want Johnny Foreigner, as British chauvinists like to say, to muck it all up. Except, you know, Johnny Foreigner does your plumbing much better than you ever did. Johnny Foreigner actually staffs your small business in London. All those things. But at the same time as you use the benefits of immigration, a large number of you rail against it. And that can lead, I mean, the real, you know, the big backstory today is the beginning of the coming apart of the European Union, which has kept the peace for 70 plus years.
Is there a clock ticking? If for instance, there is this, everybody goes into their own corner in nationalism and says, all right, we'll go it alone and that will be fine. And the, you know, the masses don't benefit economically from all this. The promises aren't delivered. Then the clock sort of runs out on this kind of rhetoric and this wishful thinking. What happens next? How long do you think that's gonna take to reveal itself, if at all?
You know, a while. But I think the danger is not, I think, you know, Greece goes to war with Slovenia. I think the danger is authoritarian regimes. And you know, there's a lot of talk of healing in Britain this morning. I'm afraid I don't believe in healing at this particular moment. I believe in fighting. What we'll learn is that pluralist, outward-looking democracy is a very fragile plant. Wherever we see it in the world. And now is the time to gird our loins and defend it to the last.
Well, the only cheering I can do is to say, remember Leicester.
That's a lovely thought, actually, but I don't want to see how Leicester voted.
Yeah, right.
Hey, all these awful immigrants seem to run extremely successful British football teams. Maybe there's a kinder face to football after all.
There we go. Simon Sharma, writer, broadcaster, history professor, and contributing editor to the FT. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Baby, bye-bye. Baby, bye-bye. Baby, bye-bye.
Mark Gilbert, columnist for Bloomberg View, joins me now to talk about the market's quick and broad reaction to being caught off guard with a scenario that investors are now going to have to do something besides imagine. Hey there, Mark. Kind of crazy over there?
It's unbelievable. It's people are shell-shocked, particularly in London, where they voted to stay in the EU. It's been a massive shock to everyone.
And what are markets saying other than, oh, my gosh, I woke up this morning and the world has changed?
They're saying, oh, my God, I woke up this morning and the world has changed for the worst, I think. If you look at what the pound's doing, the pound's at its lowest since 1985. Stocks are down. And all across the financial markets, not just the UK markets, people are showing signs of shock. People are talking about a Lehman moment. It's not quite that bad, but it's certainly not what everyone expected when they were heading into the office this morning.
Well, Lehman moment would suggest what? That, Greece is going to cease to exist or, Scotland is going to, float off into the North Sea. I mean, I don't know how to really figure what the investment message is. Is it that the value of everything in Britain is going to go down? Europe is going to break up? What do you think this represents in terms of what's next?
Well, certainly the latter is a risk, the idea that Europe might break up, that other countries might decide they too want to hold their own referendums and maybe decide to exit the European Union. Certainly that's the mood music across the financial markets. It also means bad news for the economy, not just the British economy, which will clearly suffer in the wake of this. But, it's a long period of negotiating for trade deals and the European economy itself is in a pretty weak state. So this doesn't help for that at all. So the general message from financial markets is, look, we could have done without this. It brings more uncertainty in both economically and politically. And so investors are fleeing to the safety of things like German government bonds and treasuries.
The argument that, Europe can certainly function without the UK is indisputable because it did before there was a European Union. Nevertheless, does this give an advantage to a resurgent China that wasn't in the picture before the EU existed?
Well, China's been growing on the international stage anyway, continuing to win trade. In various measures, it's now outpassing other countries. It now has more supercomputers, for example, than the US does, which is a recent development. It's the renminbi share, its currency, its share of global reserves is rising. Its share of global trade in currency terms is also rising. And I think that was inexorable anyway. For Europe, yes, Europe can exist without the UK. But what it can't do is ignore the message that the UK is sending, which is that the move to ever closer union is not popular with the citizens of Europe generally. The idea of a European super state, a United States of Europe, that needs to be scaled back. Otherwise, you will see other countries voting to depart. And if the European project breaks up, that'll be terrible news for all those other countries.
Mark Gilbert is a columnist for Bloomberg View, speaking to us from London. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
You love me or leave me or let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to advance cutting-edge research and cures and committed to helping to make someday today for thousands of blood cancer patients. Learn more at lls.org.
But nighttime is my time for just reminiscing.
A look now in Washington, D.C. In late November of 2014, President Barack Obama, frustrated with Congress's inability to pass substantial immigration reform, decided he would just circumvent the partisan deadlock Congress and issue his own order, a move he defended at the time.
The actions I'm taking are not only lawful, they're the kinds of actions taken by every single Republican president and every single Democratic president for the past half century.
But the Supreme Court on Thursday, in a split 4-4 decision, effectively deferring to a lower Texas court's ruling, blocked Obama's plan. As a result, approximately 5 million unauthorized immigrants who are parents of legal citizens or permanent residents will now be at risk of deportation. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the court voted for legal sanity and to restrain the White House.
This is a win for the Constitution. It's a win for Congress. And it's a win in our fight to restore the separation of powers. Presidents don't write laws. Congress writes laws.
Did President Obama overstep his power? With me now to discuss the broader precedence of this ruling is Eric Citron, partner at Goldstein & Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Alina Kagan and a guest contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So is this about separation of powers or is this about immigration?
Folks would say it's about both. The immediate effect of the case is limited to President Obama's expanded immigration program for Dreamers and for their families. But the principles that the challengers were invoking have to do with the limits of the president's ability to act without Congress in achieving changes to immigration law.
In the opinion that now, I guess, comes from the circuit court, since it was a 4-4 decision, the principle here is that any money spent on any program requires congressional authorization, and so therefore, because presumably some money was spent to operate whatever it was that the president wanted to accomplish in the executive order, it did not have approval. Is that right?
Well, I think the issue is, in order to get into court and to challenge the administration's action, Texas had to show that it suffered some concrete injury. And Texas's argument was that it was having to pay money out to create driver's licenses for people covered by the program, and that loss of money constituted a concrete injury that gave them a right to be in court. I think there's a kind of odd mismatch between that injury and the set of merits arguments that Texas was making about why the program was unlawful. But that's what kept them there, that loss of money. And so that's what entitled the states to have a lawsuit in the first place.
Which means that according to the separation of powers principles, the president can't do something unilaterally that would cause the states to have to spend money. And if they go to court to reverse it, you know, the whole White House program gets thrown out. It's not a balancing of the cost of driver's license versus the hardship of immigrants, right?
Right, exactly. This loss of money that Texas suffered was just the hook that allowed them to stay in court, and then they can make their arguments about whether or not the president is allowed to act unilaterally in this area. The Fifth Circuit said that the president could not do so. The Supreme Court technically affirms that judgment in deciding the case 4-4, but that has no precedential effect. It's not like the Supreme Court has voted in favor of that outcome or opinion. That opinion will continue to control the case in the Fifth Circuit, but if it ever comes back to the Supreme Court, this issue or even this case, the court would be free to reconsider what the Fifth Circuit has said.
Although it does appear that both the Supreme Court and a number of circuit courts have expressed a strong preference that Congress take up this matter and resolve immigration, and that there not be this policy by fiat coming out of the White House, whatever they think about separation of powers. Would you agree with that?
I will say this. I think the Constitution is set up so that the fundamental first crack at policy lies with Congress, who passes the laws, and the president, who either signs or doesn't sign them into law with the veto power. And the options, the range of policy options that are available to Congress, vastly outnumber what the president is allowed to do. Now, the president is our prosecutor in chief, and since immigration is essentially a choice about where to focus prosecutorial resources and whom to deport and when, the president does have a lot of flexibility in putting that law into effect. But there's a whole vast array of regulatory and legal issues that surround immigration, and it is far better, I think no one would dispute, for Congress to sort them out than for the president to take what actions he can in his discretion.
Finally, you know, stepping way back here, if we look at the beginning of the Bush 43 administration up until now, many would argue that there's been a fairly steady course of growth in executive power on the national security front, predominantly in the Bush administration and perhaps in other places in the Obama administration. Would you say this vote and maybe some others that go along with it might signal that the pendulum is about to swing in the other direction, or is this just a one-off?
I think there's definitely a sense in which the Bush administration expanded the role of the presidency, especially in international affairs and defense spaces. And the Democrats, thinking, well, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, have expanded the power of the presidency in domestic affairs. And the optimist would say, well, you know, having faced down that expanded power, both sides have recognized that it ought to have its limits The cynic would say, no, the fundamental principle here is this is only okay when my side is in power and not when yours is. And I think there is – it just remains to be seen which direction that ends up going.
Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein & Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan and a guest contributor to the irreplaceable SCOTUS blog. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Look, I know how tough it is for you to say goodbye, so I'll say.
I'll see you. Not if I see you first.
Bye-bye, boy.
Have fun storming the castle. Bye.
Doctor, I'd like to kiss you goodbye.
Good night, sweet prince.
Because you're getting on that plane.
I don't understand. What about you?
I'm staying here with him.
Yeah, we'll always not have Paris if the EU decision is any indication. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, is here thinking about goodbyes in the films of the weekend. Rafer, thanks so much.
Thanks for squeezing me in on a busy day,
absolutely,
John.
Independence Day. We're not going to talk about it because it's opening today, but it's not being screened for critics. So
nope. One of the most successful films in history, not being screened for critics. The sequel, bad sign.
What did they know about this vote, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the Neon Demon.
Where's your card?
I don't have one yet.
Jessie's new in town, but she's just been signed by Roberta Hoffman.
How old are you?
19.
Any runway experience?
Not really.
Okay, let's see the walk, dear.
Is this Deer Hunter meets the world of supermodels?
not quite. That's Elle Fanning playing Jessie. She's not 19. She's actually only 16. And she's arrived in L.A. to become a model. This is actually a lot like The Hunger, that old Ridley Scott movie with Bowie and Deneuve and Sarandon. You know, you've got these kind of vampiric beauties circling around this innocent ingenue. It's from Nicholas Winding Refn, who did Drive. So it's very stylish, very moody. I also think it's a little bit simplistic. I think it wants to be like a dark satire, a kind of David Cronenberg horror satire of the fashion industry. But I think Nicholas Winding Refn winds up abusing and mocking these women on the screen. And it kind of sounds to me like it's kind of old-fashioned misogyny, really, when you get down to it.
They don't come to life.
They really don't. They're all as frozen as models usually are in the fashion industry, and it just doesn't quite work for me.
A lot of interest in The Free State of Jones, which is a movie about the period of Reconstruction that's not often looked at in history. Matthew McConaughey stars.
Cheer, Lieutenant. You steal our corn. We got nothing to feed the hogs. We can't feed the hogs. We got nothing to put in the smokehouse. We got nothing to put in the smokehouse. We starve in the winter. That's murder, ain't it?
That guy gives you goosebumps, I have to say.
Yeah, this is based on a true story of Newton Knight. He was a Confederate Army deserter. Secedes, starts his own territory based at least partly on the principle of racial equality, and he winds up marrying a slave, a common law marriage to a slave, played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw. You know, the scenes of him rising up against the Confederates and establishing his own state are really, really interesting, really compelling. Gary Ross, the director who also wrote this, I think goes beyond the Civil War. Like you say, he goes into Reconstruction, into emancipation. He also flash forwards a lot to the 1940s to a trial where one of Newton Knight's descendants is facing miscegenation charges because he is 1/8 black. So I think the point here is that Ross is trying to say that the enemies that Knight fought back in the Civil War, the enemies of racism and prejudice, are still with us. But I think that makes for a very long movie, and it kind of wrecks the rhythm of the story. And even though I think this movie does a lot of good, and McConaughey is very good, it's a little tough for me to wholeheartedly recommend this film.
Worth checking out. But if you don't want to do that, go see The Shallows, which is Jaws meets Castaway.
You know, I made these plans 9 months ago. The whole reason I planned to come on this trip was to find the secret beach.
Not too many gringos here.
Yeah, bummer.
Gracias a Dios.
I like Blake Lively. I like sharks.
I do, too. And I like the director, Jaume Coye Serra, if I'm pronouncing his name right. He did Nonstop, which was set entirely in a plane. Great little thriller. And I thought he could do the same here. You've got a surfer on a little rock and a shark. That's it. That's the whole movie. It's a little too stripped down. It kind of becomes a waiting game where the shark is just circling and circling. Didn't quite work for me. I'm sorry I don't have better news on that one, John.
I'd ask you the question about what happens to the shark or Blake Lively, but I guess we don't want to spoil the movie. Rafer Guzman, have a great weekend. Film critic for Newsday, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Stranded on a beach with a dead body? One new movie says just leave it alone.
How
Why did you hit me?
I'm sorry. I thought you were dead.
Am I dead?
I don't think so. You're talking.
In the new film Swiss Army Man, political correctness and outrageousness share a small island along with a castaway played by Paul Dano and a corpse played by Daniel Radcliffe, who becomes Dano's survival tool for producing water, creating fire, and guiding him to hope and home. Directors Dan Kwan and Daniel Schweinert admit the plot is absurd to the point of creepy, but this film gave them their first taste of artistic autonomy, something they say they are unlikely to give up ever again.
One of the things we knew we needed was, even though the idea was kind of insane, we wanted people who could execute in a relatable way these bizarre characters.
The script evolved for like years. It was always just like something we were like kicking around, and then even the writing process was like pretty painful until we found the right actors, you know. And there were a couple factors that kind of led us to Paul and Daniel. One, they're super good at acting, so we're like big fans, so that helped.
But Paul Dano has this just morose kind of hopeless quality to his demeanor that when he even cracks the tiniest bit of a smile, it's almost as though world peace has happened.
Yeah, he's like Kanye in that way. Yeah. Where he's like, oh, he smiled.
The thing that I love about this movie, and you say it's an insane premise, but in thinking about it, you know, Castaway is this sort of ancient premise. And if you're on an island, all you've got is hope. And that if something washes up, you know, it will save you. But of course, it doesn't. But your premise is actually, if anything washes up, that's positive.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think that is so truthful. I mean, that's really
cool.
I like that.
Yeah,
and like, it's also about finding beauty and hope in the most unexpected places. And I think we wanted to create that contrast, like a very large contrast between something beautiful and something that you would probably hate to have wash up on your shore. And I guess that's kind of like the like a common like trope amongst any buddy comedy. It's kind of like you're the last person I want to take along with me on this journey. But we kind of took that to an extreme. We kind of found that buddy in a dead body.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun.
Yeah, like one of the recurring like tropes of the whole film is like trash and garbage and like just things you don't want, things that get discarded. When we were location scouting, like we would go out in the woods and there's trash and garbage all over our most beautiful forests. And we were like, that's a really interesting thing. Like, let's put that in the movie. And it kind of thematically became like really fun to kind of explore how a hopeless man could find hope in like other people's scraps.
How do you decide to give superpowers to a dead body without losing dead body quality?
We kind of realized, like, by making him dead and kind of wiping him clean, like, he's kind of a clean slate, we were able to kind of, in a really simple, fun way, deconstruct what a human is and, like, how we learn and how we grow and then eventually how we gain our neuroses and our fears and our weird shame that we, you know, all these things that make up a being. We were able to kind of, from the ground up, watch Daniel Radcliffe's character piece by piece become a fully realized human. And so I think
he's kind of like an adorable childlike character in that way, where you kind of get to see the world through his like his naive eyes.
So rather than going the zombie route, we kind of went a dead person as the child.
How closely did Dano and Radcliffe work together as an ensemble, and how did you see that emerge on camera?
So intimately. I mean, we realized, you know, it's kind of a two-hander. They're going to be on set together every day. Like, Paul has to drag Daniel around for, you know, the majority of the film. They threw themselves into it, and they, like, got along wonderfully well, which I think comes across in the film. You can kind of see that, like, there's a genuine understanding between the two of them. Like, they really, like, communicated well. We all did, you know. It's kind of just, like, the four of us in the woods figuring this thing out.
If this movie were to just become huge, be the, you know, my big fat Greek dead body that washed up on the shore.
I love that.
Good old title.
What would it mean? What would people be connecting with that you feel is the universal kind of message here?
The movie's weird in an attempt to kind of shake us out of our comfort zone and like, oh, I've seen this movie before. Like to put you in a place where you're like, okay, I haven't seen this movie before, and then say some pretty like universal things. So if it reaches a big audience, it'll be because people are refreshed by that.
We're all a little weird in our own weird different ways. But when we find the right kind of weirdness in other people. It's a very unique connection because I think everyone is weird.
Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert are the directors of Swiss Army Man, starring Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano. The film is out in theaters today. Beneath the stirred-up dust in global financial markets is the growing debt crisis among college students in the U.S. and the growing concern that this is another financial bubble about to burst. Now easy credit, rising tuition costs, and aggressive lenders have created a debt spiral that has put the brakes on economic opportunity for young graduates and has made tax-supported veterans looking for an education easy pickings for the most unscrupulous of schools.
Number one, our veterans are being charged through their GI Bill benefits about twice the rate of the tuition at most other colleges and universities. And secondly, the results are, as expected, disappointing, with very few of them ending up with the training or education they need for a good job.
That's Democratic Senator from Illinois Dick Durbin speaking about one piece of a much larger problem. A new investigation by Vice takes another look at student debt in for-profit and nonprofit institutions. Gianna Taboni is a correspondent for Vice.
We found that this is an issue across the country. We specifically looked at Globe University in Minnesota, talked to the Minnesota State Attorney General there, who is suing them for fraudulent practices. She introduced us to one of the former admissions officers there, who I was frankly shocked by everything that he admitted. He's sort of taking on a whistleblower role right now. But what he said is he had a script that he read off of in order to recruit students in order to hit a quota.
Well, and this is the kind of predicament that that pitch produced. Here's the story, as far as we can tell, of Maggie Scheel, who's a graduate of Globe University, the institution you just spoke about.
Despite having a four-year degree and good grades, the only job that she's been able to get doesn't require a college degree at all.
I owe just over 38 now, 38,000. Last month, I made $650.
Can I ask how much money you have in your bank account right now?
16 cents.
Right now, 16 cents.
Yeah. We're about 2 months behind on all of our bills.
But, so, like, literally, how do you pay your loans?
I don't. I'm defaulted right now.
And the circumstances are less important here than the fact that these are people who are probably ill-equipped to deal with these kinds of financial pressures. People in their early 20s, people in their mid-20s, or veterans trying to assimilate and get back into the workplace.
Sure. What we found is that these people, when they were prospective students, didn't know exactly what they were getting into. So now, after graduating, Maggie Scheel, as an example, $38,000 in debt and making less than she was making before she got the education. So clearly, there's something wrong with this system. And when you sort of zoom out and look at the big picture, 10% of college students go to for-profit. So that number is not very high. But around 40% of students who default on loans go to these schools. Critics like Elizabeth Warren are enraged by this and would say it's more than just a broken system. It's a predatory system.
It's also an inflationary spiral that's taken place. And you took a look at what was the plan B here, and that was don't go to the for-profits, don't go to the, you know, higher institutions, the Ivy League institutions, go to the state schools, which were once the affordable option. But that's even less of the case because the debt that's so available drives up the price of tuition. The fiscal support that's coming from the states goes down, and you have a situation like F. King Alexander, who's the president of Louisiana State University.
Tuition has gone up significantly, about 65% for us. We're quietly privatizing public higher education throughout the country. The children in elementary school are not going to have a public affordable option by the time they get out of high school.
That's a giant headline. Privatizing public education. That's what this amounts to?
I mean, it's just kind of unbelievable. And what shocked me most about that interview and also talking to the governor is that President Alexander, he says before it was funding for that school was 70% state funding, right? And 30% student funding. Now that's flipped. It's 80% is on the shoulders of the students, 20% is state funding. It's just sort of unbelievable. And when we talked to the governor, you know, I said, are lawmakers allocating less money to higher education because they know that students have access to money, to loans? And he goes, absolutely. And not just in Louisiana, but across the country.
It's a bubble.
Yeah. I mean, it's scary, especially people have made the comparison to the mortgage crisis. And Elizabeth Warren sort of says, okay, pump the brakes. It's not that bad. But the comparison's being made, which I think is saying a lot.
And, you know, you feel like it's a crisis if you're a 25-year-old and you're looking at, you know, $80,000 of debt and you're defaulting on everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a scary thing for former students who are trying to pay back debt. I mean, we talked to a couple, Kaitra McCarty and her husband, Brandon, in Massachusetts. Together, they owe $291,000 in loans. So they actually can't even afford rent. They're living with her mom, even though, you know, they're at a place in their life where they thought they'd be saving toward buying a house, thinking about having children. Neither of those things they're sure they'll ever be able to do.
Job prospects? I mean, what degrees do they have?
They have master's degrees, actually. They're teachers. They're public school teachers. So again, these are professions where they're doing God's work and they can't even survive. I mean, Kaitra isn't just a public school teacher. She has to have three other jobs just to make ends meet. And again, not even paying rent.
Gianna Taboni is a correspondent for Vice. You can watch her reporting on student debt tonight at 11 p.m. Eastern Time on HBO.
Oh, Dad, won't you spare me over till another year? Well, what is this that I can't see with ice cold hands taking hold of me?
Not to be. Bluegrass legend Dr. Ralph Stanley was not spared, died at his home in Sandy Ridge, Virginia yesterday. That's the tune "O Death" from the movie "O Brother, Where Art Thou," loosely based on the story of the Clinch River Boys, Stanley's band. The Doctor of Bluegrass with a distinctive white cowboy hat came out of Big Spraddle in Southwest Virginia in the 1940s after serving in the Army. His axe, the banjo, clawhammer style, trained by his mama. His voice from the heart. This doctor wanted to be a veterinarian when he was a boy, but we are so happy he chose to heal us all with music. Dr. Ralph Stanley was 89 years young. Today is a living archive of recorded sounds. You've got voices, tweets, posts, vines, videos, and song, and add to that every piece of music ever recorded, and every individual track of all that music, and any individual newsmaker talking about anything, and you can see how the power of today's hip-hop artists comes from the vast ocean of recorded civilization, available for anyone to sample. DJ Shadow grew up on samples, creating his own gigantic archive of the mainstream and the obscure. He was producer in 1996 of one of the most influential albums of all time, Introducing. DJ Shadow, a.k.a. Josh Davis's main gig, is live performance, but he's got a new album out today called The Mountain Will Fall. DJ Shadow finds music both a retreat from the world and a way to find it by reaching people.
If I'm going to make music, it has to be my only focus that day. And I have to ease into it. At least for me, I can't just drop into music making mode for 2 hours and then skip out to do some, you know, press or something like that. It takes me about 2 or 3 hours to kind of get into a zone, and it may sound overdramatic and corny and stuff, but it's like you're tapping into some kind of intellectual superhighway or spiritual connection for me to be able to feel like I'm in a zone. And when I'm in that zone, I'm seeking some kind of emotional resonance out of the music that I'm making. And that doesn't always mean melancholy. It can also mean, you know, rage, or it can mean humor. It can mean a lot of different things. A lot of other music that people called, you know, trip hop or whatever, you know, instrumental hip hop, to me, they just sounded like beats that were missing a rapper. To me, there's a big difference between, you know, build, drop, outro, and what I tried to bring to the table on this album, which is I wanted every track to be a fully formed thought. That's why there's a lot of songs on the album that feel like three songs in one. I mean, there's a song called California that starts off with one sensibility and goes into another and then another. I wanted in 4 minutes you to feel like, wait, is this all one ID or have I gone through three songs? Where am I at on the album, you know? I want it to feel like you're getting more than you expected out of each song. I wanted to work with other instrumentalists because it's something that I think is a challenge. With the Matthew Halsell stuff, the track that we did together, it's called Ashes to Oceans. It's totally X plus Y equals equation. I mean, I could have never done that track working with anyone else. And I think he would probably say the same. I mean, it's an odd track. It has a lot of weird things happening in it. And yet it's just really emotionally resonant. And that's what I think we both wanted from the track, because that's what I get from his music. I just said, go into a studio and record some stuff. And I said to him, like, I understand you're going to probably make some really beautiful stuff, and you have to understand I'm going to kind of rip it up, and I'm going to trash it, and I'm going to do something to it that is musically wrong, and, you know what I mean, from a conventional sense. And he was totally up for that. A couple of little piano lines that spoke to me, a couple of little bass lines that spoke to me, and just built something that could have never been built if he hadn't done that session. And I think what I did to it is something that couldn't really have been done by anyone else in a way. Go back. I have to just keep going forward for, you know, good or bad. What I don't really understand so much is the demand that an artist not do that. An artist should evolve, should follow their muse, because otherwise it's a creative dead end. And all of my favorite music has a out of sync, out of time element to it that allows me to revisit it in, you know, every 10 years or so and find new value in it. I mean, that to me is, again, kind of the essence of good art. Hanging on to the same core values, I think, for what I'm looking for in music and for what I think my role is in music, which is to provide some kind of alternative. As long as I'm doing that, then I feel like I'm achieving something. People know that I champion funk music, and it's a genre that I will always love as kind of the precursor to a lot of the energy of hip hop. But I mean, a certain type of funk that felt really raw and challenging to play 20 years ago in sets now seems really tame and not creative to do so anymore. As DJs, we have helped define what people value. 20 years ago, you could not hear a lot of the music that we were championing anywhere. I mean, there was no internet. And I mean, now you can turn on the TV and hear records like Marlena Shaw, California Soul, and incredible bongo band Apache, and all these records that DJs like Jazzy J and Premier and by us championing those records, they are now mainstream. They've been re-co-opted. What was once ignored and lost has now taken its kind of rightful place in the mainstream, which is great, but it also dictates to me that It's no longer my place to champion that music. Everybody else is.
Hi.
DJ Shadow is an American producer and DJ. His new album, The Mountain Will Fall, is out today. And here's something to take with you today into your weekend. In 1919, the Nobel Committee gave the Nobel Peace Prize to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, who bet his career and political legacy on the League of Nations he helped to found. And the U.S. Senate refused to join, condemning the League to irrelevance and eventual obscurity. It was broken up. In 2009, Barack Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize, and in 2012, the European Union got the prize, the same EU that Barack Obama bet his political legacy on by urging the people of the UK to remain in, and that the UK refused to stay in a historic vote this week, possibly starting a chain of events that could send the EU the way of the old League of Nations. But where are those Nobel Peace Prizes, man? I don't want one of those. Don't even ever nominate me for one. I'm serious. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, whose goal is a world without blood cancers, funding research for new treatments and targeted approaches to therapy. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.